honor, tradition, history. Every United States president is cut from a different cloth, but all end up woven into the same comforting American-grown cotton blanket of this great nation's exceptional legacy. But that same blanket is also a death shroud, each individual thread ultimately ending in the same place for all those who serve as president. Amidst the roiling seas of American politics, where so many fishers of men cast lines of lacquered lies to capture hungry mackerels gasping for truth in their lives in an empty sea, one truth shines like a lighthouse through broken rain clouds. All presidential stories, good or bad, end the same way. The end. We're the Crispy Noodle Team, and this is the Dead Presidents Podcast. I'm Michael Costanzo, joined by Rich Liebig. Now here's your host, Nana.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt is often considered by many to be a highly influential president who revolutionized social welfare systems and helped guide America through World War II. He's also notable for being the longest-serving president, winning four straight elections and serving three before passing away during his fourth term. His presidency was so unprecedented that afterward, laws were passed to ensure no president could serve more than two terms. FDR was, and is, undoubtedly a landmark president who shaped the future of the country with a progressive mindset that was truly ahead of its time. But flip that dime, because there's two sides to every coin.
FDR may have had the longest presidency, but what of the forgotten individuals, those commander-in-chiefs who are relegated to just one insignificant term? Oftentimes, they get pushed to the side halls of American history, forgotten in their cobwebbed corners. But there exist a select few who manage to make their cobwebs interesting.
There are some presidents who sadly never managed to finish a single term, cut down in their prime by illness or assassins. They hold a special place in that collective American memory as trivia.
Let's go one step further. There's one president in particular who crosses that line from trivia back to obscurity and then to notoriety, all while being truly an influential man who's received none of the recognition.
President William Henry Harrison, the one-month president. William Henry Harrison, the ninth president of the United States, led a life of presidency, both filled with remarkable moments, despite their easily forgotten nature. Harrison was born in 1773, the son of Benjamin Harrison V, a founding father and member of a long-standing and powerful American political family tracing their American roots back to the 1630s. This also makes Harrison the last U.S. president technically born as a British royal, subject of the original 13 colonies before the U.S. Revolutionary War a few years later.
Clearly, Harrison already had some clout behind his name, and he made a note in presidential history just by being born at a particular time. But there has to be some reason he was elected in the first place.
Most politicians elected to the highest office have a long list of accomplishments and a staggering resume. Harrison was no different.
Correct. Despite being one of the most commonly overlooked presidents because of his short term, he actually had quite a long career before entering office.
Most notably, he had one of the catchiest political campaign slogans of all time, Tippecanoe and Tyler Too. That had to have come from somewhere or something important.
Right. Every high school history class mentions that. It marks one of his most notable moments.
All true, but we'll get back to the Battle of Tippecanoe because we need to start farther back. Back to when Harrison was making history years before. Harrison started his public career in the late 1790s, gaining acclaim and reputation among the aristocracy as a frontier leader. He became territorial secretary to the rapidly growing Northwest Territory, which included parts of six different present-day states: Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota. There, he ran a successful horse breeding enterprise and championed lower land prices, two hot topics for all frontier residents.
Well, it was a simpler time.
When it was decided the Northwest Territory population had grown enough to have a delegate in the U.S. Congress, Harrison jumped at the opportunity, campaigning on a platform to encourage further migration to the territory, which would eventually lead to statehood. And it was on that popular stance that in 1798, at the age of 26, he defeated the son of the territorial governor by one vote to become the first congressional delegate for the Northwest Territory.
But his post didn't last very long.
No, because he was already moving on to bigger and better things. After the Northwest Territory was formally split into two territories in 1800, then-President John Adams appointed Harrison as governor of the newly established Indiana Territory in 1801, allowing him to make history once again. And apparently, he was quite successful in that role, earning reappointment in 1803, 1806, and 1809. In this role, Harrison negotiated 11 treaties with Native American leaders that granted the U.S. government more than 60 million acres of land, including parts of what would become Indiana and Missouri and most of Illinois. But it wasn't all positive for Harrison.
No. Unfortunately, part of his platform during this time were his pro-slavery views. He lobbied the government to suspend parts of the Northwest Ordinance enacted in 1787 that prevented the expansion of slavery into newly formed territories. He requested a 10-year suspension to, as he claimed, encourage settlement and make the territory economically viable. Thankfully, Congress rejected the idea.
But that wouldn't stop his pro-slavery agenda. In 1803 and 1805, Harrison successfully enacted territorial law that were able to evade parts of the Northwest Ordinance that would authorize indentures, allow slaves to be brought into the territory, and gave masters authority to determine the length of indentured servitude. Of course, these laws caused turmoil in the territory's large anti-slavery population.
What's interesting about all of this is that it was President Jefferson, himself a slaveholder, that helped spearhead a defeat for Harrison's pro-slavery movement. Under the secret Jefferson-Lehman Compact, Jefferson donated money to James Lehman, a minister in the area, to found anti-slavery churches throughout Illinois and Indiana. This eventually led to citizens coming together and organizing politically to defeat pro-slavery legislation. A new anti-slavery factor came to power around 1810 in the newly formed Indiana Territory General Assembly, which promptly repealed the Indenturing Acts passed in 1803 and 1805. Harrison's political authority began to wane as the territorial legislature assumed more responsibility as the territory advanced toward statehood.
It should be noted, however, that many historians believe the secret Jefferson-Lehman anti-slavery compact is unsubstantiated. Still,
it was all very convenient. But what does any staunch pro-slavery person do when faced with progressive ideals and a changing society?
Retire from politics, rejoin the military to hunt Native Americans, and wage war with the British again.
And that brings us back to 1811, the Battle of Tippecanoe. The Battle of Tippecanoe during Tecumseh's War is probably the most notable event in Harrison's life. Harrison at this point was transitioning back to his military career. One of his first duties was to negotiate with the Native American leaders Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa, who opposed the Fort Wayne Treaty, which granted the U.S. government 3 million acres of Native American land.
The government and the Native Americans differed on the point of whether a single Native American tribe could speak on behalf of all Native American tribes and sell land to the government.
Talks did not go as planned, and both sides quickly rose to anger. Tecumseh left, issuing a warning that he would gather tribes to form a confederation and seek an alliance with the British.
The U.S. government, of course, did not take this lightly. They couldn't have those pesky Native inhabitants getting any funny ideas that would interfere with the government's plans to forcibly take and settle their lands.
Harrison was given permission to take 1,000 troops and march against the growing Native American Confederacy as a show of force and intimidate them into making peace. Because what says peace better than a military force marching into another group's lands?
Ah, the epitome of peace.
Unsurprisingly, the Native Americans didn't see it that way. They launched a surprise attack on Harrison's forces in the early morning hours. Estimates put the Native American strength between 500 and 700 warriors, much smaller than Harrison's 1,000-plus force. Despite this, Tenskwatawa's forces suffered less casualties than Harrison's, only retreating after running low on ammunition and as the morning light revealed their smaller numbers.
All told, the battle lasted 2 hours. Afterward, Harrison led his men to the nearby Native American village of Prophetstown, which he then burned to the ground, destroying or confiscating all the supplies and food stores in the process and allowing his troops to dig up bodies to scalp.
Harrison led a short but horrific military campaign against Tecumseh's forces, a small example of the greater general mindset and actions against the Native American population for most of American history. He was hailed as an American hero.
Connections between Tecumseh, Tippecanoe, and the British began to grow in America at that time. Despite hard evidence, many believed the British incited the tribes to violence, and the public outcry for retaliation led to the declaration of war against the British. Just 3 decades after fighting the British in the Revolutionary War, America wanted another go at them in the War of 1812.
Harrison became Brigadier General and led American forces to several key victories, including recapturing Detroit and winning the Battle of Thames, during which Tecumseh was killed. Despite this, Harrison was reassigned and command of the front was given to one of his subordinates. This move spurred Harrison to retire from his military career. Afterward, Congress found that Harrison was mistreated in being reassigned, thus making his resignation justified. He was awarded the Gold Medal for his services.
Harrison rode his military success in Tecumseh's War and the War of 1812 to further his political career. He ran for president in 1836 as one of 4 Whig Party candidates, the plan being to deny Martin Van Buren the necessary electoral votes to win the presidency.
It didn't work. Van Buren became the 8th president of the United States, but Harrison was not deterred. After winning over 36% of the popular vote, or about as much as modern Republicans need to win elections, Harrison would once again set his sights on the presidency in 1840. This time, he ran as the sole candidate on the Whig ticket, but more importantly, he used the catchiest campaign slogan of all time, Tippecanoe and Tyler Too.
It even came with a song.
What's the cause of this commotion, motion, motion, our country through? It is the ball a-rolling on for Tippecanoe and Tyler Too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler Too, and with them we'll be
breathtaking.
Truly.
Tippecanoe and Tyler Too became one of the most well-known campaign slogans of all time. This rallying cry marked Harrison's presidential run as one of the earliest to use a slogan and one of the first in which the candidate actively campaigned. Harrison was also able to turn the Democrats' insult of being a hard cider-drinking, log-cabin dweller to his favor by creating a grassroots campaign and positioning himself as a man of the people. This move was doubly notable as Harrison came from wealth and power himself. That didn't deter him from giving impassioned hours-long campaign speeches at massive rallies, almost as long as this show.
At the time, people were taken aback by Harrison's strategies, but it's hard to deny the impact of it all. This idea that a wealthy man who hates racial minorities could successfully campaign to economically disadvantaged people and convince them that he's one of them on the basis of former success that may or may not have come from questionable events. It's truly...
It's almost like we've seen this somewhere else.
Quite. Anyway, Harrison, of course, won the election with John Tyler as his vice president to become the 9th president of the United States. And 1 month later, Tyler became the 10th president of the United States.
It's time.
It's time.
It's time for the death of President William Henry Harrison, the 1 month president. Harrison's inauguration took place on Thursday, March 4th, 1841, and the newly elected president, despite winning the election, still felt he had something to prove. He wanted to show voters and politicians alike that he was still the same war hero he once was 3 decades earlier.
It was a dark and stormy... well, almost. The day of Harrison's inauguration was cold and wet, like any typical early spring day.
And at the age of 68... Harrison was a straight G homie. He didn't wear any hat or overcoats, and he refused a closed carriage, instead opting to ride through the streets on horseback.
Having acquired a taste for giving long-winded speeches on the campaign trail, he then proceeded to give the longest inaugural address in U.S. history, clocking in at nearly 8,500 words and 2 hours.
It had already been edited for length as well.
He continued to ride through the streets on horseback on his way to 3 separate inaugural balls, one of which cost $10 a person. A whole $10!
That's $243 in 2018. Over 1,000 people showed up.
This is all just a very long-winded way of saying you should all wear a coat when going out in the rain, because exactly 1 month later, on April 4th, 1841, William Henry Harrison was dead.
Whoa, 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 wait a minute, wait a minute. Slow down, wait a minute. Can we jump to the death that fast? I don't think so.
Certainly not. The events surrounded Harrison's care, final moments, and what came after are all noteworthy, because as with everything Harrison, it caused a stir. Let's start from the beginning. A cold. Take care of yourselves, people.
Harrison first fell ill on March 26th, 1841, a few weeks after his epically long inaugural showing. Over the course of 2 days, his symptoms grew progressively worse, and a team of doctors was called in. The prevailing historical theory is that his inauguration is directly linked with his sickness and ultimate death.
His symptoms started as general stomach discomfort, headaches, and indigestion, but soon progressed to severe chills, violent pains along his right side, which he attributed to constipation, and complaints of thirst and nausea.
His doctors diagnosed him with right lower lobe pneumonia. His head doctor, Thomas Miller, did not perform bloodlettings, which was the common cure at the time, done in the thought that it would draw out the disease. Instead, he administered a various drug treatment and other treatments considering standard at the time, including opium, ipecac, various laxatives, medicines that contained mercury, mustard plasters, enemas, and a hot brandy toddy. This did not go well.
His symptoms only worsened. The laxatives didn't do much, and the various drugs troubled his breathing and indigestion. But at least the opium worked to ease some of the pain. Consulting doctors were brought in, and they agreed with Dr. Thomas Miller's diagnosis and treatment course. But ultimately, nothing worked.
By April 2nd, roughly 7 days after first consulting with the doctors, Harrison was nearing his end. He became lethargic and difficult to arouse. His pulse was described in Miller's notes as slow, hobbing, and intermittent, skin dark and muddy. His abdomen was distended, and his extremities were blue and cold.
At 8:45 p.m. on April 3rd, Harrison uttered his final words to Vice President John Tyler, saying, "Sir, I wish you to understand the true principles of government. I wish them carried out. I ask nothing more."
Around midnight on April 4th, Harrison passed away. But that's not the end of the story. Evidence as recent as 2014 paints a different picture of the true cause of his death, an alarming, disgusting, and upsetting cause.
Historians never question the diagnosis, but a case study by Jane McHugh from Oxford Academic's Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal reveals that the original diagnosis and treatment course were both absolutely wrong. You see, not even Dr. Thomas Miller was fully convinced of what he suspected to be pneumonia. He wrote in his notes, quote, "The disease was not viewed as a case of pure pneumonia, but as this was the most palpable affection, the term pneumonia afforded a succinct and intelligible answer to the innumerable questions as to the nature of the attack."
So what then caused the illness, if not the fabled romp through D.C. in the rain? What was actually wrong with President William Henry Harrison? Research suggests it may have been moving into the White House itself.
We didn't always have so many creature comforts in America. In 1841, we lacked a big one, a sewer system. At the time, sewage from buildings simply flowed into public grounds, which happened to be a short distance from the White House, where it stagnated and became a fetid marsh. Meanwhile, the White House water supply came from springs, located just 7 blocks away from where night soil was deposited by government workers. These truly horrific set of circumstances point to a new culprit of Harrison's demise, a type of typhoid fever and gastroenteritis from the bacteria Salmonella typhi.
As further evidence of this being the true cause, Harrison wasn't the only case. 2 other presidents, James K. Polk and Zachary Taylor, were both believed to have suffered the same illnesses during their presidencies.
In fact, President Zachary Taylor, who was also noted as having a very short presidency at just 1 year, also died from the same ailment. Well, there's some speculation he may have died from eating bad cherries and cream, or had been secretly assassinated, but that's a different story for a different April Fool's joke.
Harrison, having a history of indigestion and acid reflux, would have been more susceptible than most to the disease. But the really grim part, Dr. Thomas Miller's insistence on prescribing laxatives and enemas, only made it worse by causing the disease to spread further and faster throughout his body. The opium also resulted in his body retaining the bacteria and helped it invade his bloodstream. This ultimately makes the true cause of death septic shock, likely from perforated intestines as a result of incorrectly treated typhoid fever and gastroenteritis.
But that's still not the end of the saga. His death was a blow to the country, and much like everything else Harrison did, it caused a mild amount of chaos.
This time, it was in the form of a constitutional crisis, my favorite crisis. Harrison was the first president to ever die in office, and literally no one knew what to do. You see, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6 of the Constitution outlines how the vice president should assume the powers and duties of the presidency in the event of a president's removal, death, or resignation. It doesn't state, though, whether there is an interim role or if the vice president indeed becomes president.
Eventually, Chief Justice Roger Taney decided if Tyler took the oath of office, he would assume the office of presidency, and both houses passed a resolution that confirmed Tyler as such.
This set a precedent that would be followed in another 7 different occasions until it was officially written in the Constitution in 1967 as part of the 25th Amendment.
Despite being the shortest-serving president and kind of an awful person, who is often relegated to basic trivia and factoids, it is hard to deny the extraordinary tale of William Henry Harrison. Through life, death, and even after death, William Henry Harrison left an indelible mark on U.S. politics.
So now that we know all the history, facts, plot twists, and impacts surrounding Harrison and his uniquely short stint as president, what did you guys think?
To learn that it was a whole different reason that killed him and that his doctor, even his doctors didn't even know what actually was his sickness and what was actually killing him is very morbid and it kind of makes you feel bad for the guy. But then on the flip side, we did his history of being in, you know, war and battle and he was scalping people. So yeah. It's kind of like he almost kind of had it coming. It was like karma was like finally coming to visit him. So I don't know. I'm in a weird mixture of thoughts. It's like half and half.
Yeah.
A part of me wants to feel sorry for him that he suffered, you know, this fate. But the other half is like he kind of had it coming because he was kind of, you know, scalping people.
Yeah. And just to piggyback on that, I mean, we didn't include some of the more gruesome details, like the actual effects of the enemas and laxatives. Because his last few weeks were really, really horrible. But, like you said, it's sort of this mixed feeling of he was scalping people, he was chasing Native Americans out of their lands by marching in an effort to intimidate them to sign peace treaties. I mean, it's all very sort of underhanded and symbolic of America at the time, unfortunately.
I just have to say that it definitely wouldn't have mentioned natural causes for his death.
Yeah,
this was the whole
lot. It was a lot past natural causes, and
yeah,
it taught me a lot about the specific death.
Yes,
which is what I wanted all along.
Right.
Yeah.
Can we get meta?
Let's pull the curtain back.
Just in case you happen to stumble into this podcast randomly, and you're like, "What is going on?" The whole reason we're doing this podcast is because Nena made a remark that she didn't know what natural causes meant on a chart. Of the president's death?
It's like a book of presidents or something. And
you said there was a chart or something that had like their deaths or something.
Yeah, and it listed, and so many of them, it stated natural causes. And I thought natural causes was just floating up to God, and there you go.
Right.
Well, how about this?
Bye-bye. Yeah, no, this is he went to hell first,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, hell, absolutely.
The bowels of hell, literally.
Not natural causes for this guy.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, not at all. And I'm glad we were able to answer that question that's been plaguing you about the causes of deaths of presidents.
Pun intended on the plaguing. Yeah. but my question is, how much policy was he able to get you know, in a month.
Not much. According to the research that I did in writing this, he basically, the only notable thing he did was he called like a special counsel and it didn't even meet because he ended up dying. So all he did was like, I want to meet these people. And then he got sick and then he died. Literally, his biggest impact to politics was the idea of campaigning, the idea of campaign slogans and going out to rallies. And he cemented the precedent that the vice president becomes the president in the event the president is.
I thought that part was really interesting because I never knew. I just thought that was a hard and fast rule that was always part of it.
This is the first time a sitting president dies in office.
Right.
And everybody had questions. How does this actually, you know, what does it look like? How does it actually happen? How does the transfer of power actually happen?
Right. What is the process? And that's what I found really interesting is it says in the Constitution, yes, the vice president assumes the role and or not the role, but the power. But does he become the president or just an interim until one is elected?
Right.
So that caused a big stir, like everything Harrison did, really.
He didn't have that much of a run, but it's like everything he did was interesting and history-making.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now I will never forget who the 9th and 10th presidents were.
There you go.
For the Quizzo.
Yeah, next time our Quizzo.
It's good Quizzo stuff. So any final remarks?
I hope that doesn't end up being me.
Yeah. Glad we have modern sewage systems now.
Yay for plumbing.
Yay. Yay, modern plumbing.
And that is William Henry Harrison.
And thus concludes our journey through the incredible life and death of William Henry Harrison and America's shortest presidential term.
Though he died a horrible death after barely serving in the highest office in the land, he will live on in America's memory.
In death, he left behind a story, perhaps not the one he would have liked, but a story worth telling nonetheless.
Forever enshrined here in this inaugural episode of the Dead Presidents Podcast, where we tell the morbid stories of the ultimate ends of the greatest leaders of the free world, because in the end,
they all end up dead. It had begun to snow again. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where William Henry Harrison lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned, slowly, as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead.
Anyway, thanks for tuning in.
The Dead Presidents Podcast is a special Crispy Noodle News Network show. If you'd like to find out more, visit our website, thecrispynoodle.com. Like and follow us on Facebook, search The Crispy Noodle. And follow us on Twitter, at The Crispy Noodle, and on Instagram, at The Crispy Noodle Podcast.
Research for this episode came from the New York Times, Oxford Academic Infectious Diseases Society of America case study, Wikipedia, the White House website, and history.com. That quote you heard at the end was a modified excerpt from the novella The Dead by James Joyce. Finally, a big thanks to Nena for providing the inspiration for the Dead Presidents Podcast.
Thanks, guys. The Dead Presidents Podcast is hosted by me, Nena, alongside Michael Costanzo and Rich Liebig. It was written by Michael Costanzo and produced by Rich Liebig and Michael Costanzo. You can hear more of our shenanigans by subscribing to the Crispy Noodle Podcast, which releases new episodes every Thursday on a variety of podcast services. Thanks for listening.